there's going to come a point where that step's going to be impossible. Is it just me, or the introductions you're giving me just getting a little weirder all the time? Something I said? Oh. Morning, when Marianne called me 2 days ago to ask me to do this, that was a little longer than that, but not too long ago. I thought, well, I'll do something a little bit more lighthearted, you know, this time. And I thought, well, I'll start with telling you a little bit about, I was privileged yet again to be part of somebody's entheogenic psilocybin experience as guide and scribe. And just had a terrific time of it. And we got to talking both during and after. And she'd come from a pretty severe reformed background. And at one point she just said, you know, there was no mirth, you know, again, it was so somber. She said, spirituality can't possibly be this somber, this harsh, this cold, you know? And I said, yeah, but would have been nice if somebody told a joke, right? She said, yeah. And she had this vision of her grandparents who were very, very, you know, sort of austere, telling each other jokes during her period. And she just made her laugh and cry. And I thought, that's, you know, again, in my ongoing campaign against earnestness, I'm just all for, I'm all for that sort of thing. So I thought, well, in the spirit of that, you know, maybe I'll give some sort of talk. I mean, the title's supposed to be somewhat tongue-in-cheek and all that. And also combined with the whole New Year's resolution thing. And my resolution is that I'm going to go back to being my more authentically miserable self. Because what I've done is deprive people, this has been incredibly selfish of me, and I have to apologize to some of the people around me, and that in being so progressive, so good, so virtuous myself, I have deprived the people around me the opportunity to practice their own resolutions, the ways in which they can and should be better. And you know who you are, and most of you are here. If you're not at Grand Valley, and every other place I go. So I put together a little list for you. No need to thank me just yet. These are things that you can work on yourselves. And since I'm coming back next week, I'd like to see some progress on these. At least one of these is going to touch you, I would think. Fear of failure or success, low self-esteem or self-doubt, fixed mindset, unresolved trauma or chronic stress, lack of emotional regulation, procrastination and avoidance habits, poor goal clarity, lack of direction, weak discipline, inconsistent effort, short-term thinking, over long-term planning, information overload, constant distraction, poor decision-making skills, lack of critical thinking, don't we see that, negative peer influence, social comparison, pressure to conform, poor physical health, sleep deprivation, poor nutrition, substance abuse, addiction to social media, constant notifications, attention fragmentation, it's only 5 minutes, just hang in there, okay? Untreated mental health conditions, addiction to social media, I already said that, see? I can't even pay attention to my own. Lack of meaning or purpose, cynicism or nihilism, fear of mortality or impermanence. You got it? At least one of those has to strike home for you. I don't know. All I care is that you do begin. Like I said, I'll be back next week, and I'm just going to not do anything in the next week, but I'm going to show up and give you an opportunity as mirror, wall, sounding board, whatever you like, to practice being better. So I was in that kind of spirit, right? Let's do the talk and that sort of thing. But then global events, the world goes on as it does. The weekly events happened as they did, and I thought, well, maybe there's another way that I should think about this title that I offered in terms of the emphasis. There's, you know, what the bleep is wrong with everybody? And that's an expression of annoyance, right? I don't know if, I mean, it's going to sound trivial, but nonetheless, it's one of those things that makes me think, what the bleep is wrong with everybody? And by the way, you can fill in your own expletive. I don't care what you use there. I'm on the phone with customer service, and something that was relatively important. And it's one of those folks I'm hearing more and more all the time. It's like her first day on the job, or she'd never seen a computer before, and so she's talking to herself about everything that's going wrong while I'm on the phone. right? My confidence level is dropping through the floors. You know, is there anybody there who's ever seen a computer before? I just don't know how this works. And this, I think you're going to have to go back and read. It's like, no, it's a whole inner monologue. It should have been an inner monologue. That, all right, what's wrong with everybody? Emphasis on the, you know. But there's another way to do it. So that's annoyance. And that is, you know, really, what the hell is wrong with everybody? What the hell is wrong with everybody? Which is more of an explication, an investigation, a kind of inquiry. Okay, what really is truly wrong with everybody? And by everybody, of course, that's kind of a rhetorical device. I don't mean everybody. I just mean, like, almost everybody, okay? And then at the heart of what's wrong with us, and it's just natural, there's not much we can do about it, is conflict. I do follow many of the great theorists, and I don't think there's any discipline in literature, philosophy, sciences, that doesn't posit conflict at the heart of who we are. Christianity, right, where, as Shannon put it in his beautiful meditation, what he sent to us, you know, he doesn't embrace the notion of fallen, neither do I, but Christians at least, I think, have it right that there's some kind of separation from ourselves, from the transcendent, divine, whatever you want to call it, for whatever reasons, and they do posit reasons that most of us might reject, but nonetheless, they've at least made the attempt. The Buddhists couldn't even be bothered with the attempt. You know, like, well, what's wrong with us? Well, you know, we could be enlightened, but we're ignorant and greedy and angry. And, well, where does that come from? Well, that's not the point. So they just, like, you know, just move ahead. Plato divides the soul into three parts. It's at odds, you know, with Freud, of course, you know, it's ego, superego. It's just nothing but conflict all the way down. From the moment we show up on the planet, it's just a series of corrective actions, you know? It's like, we're so happy you're here, we love you so much, now be something different, it's so much, you know, it's like, there's just so much work to be done, right? And humans have spent most of our time on Earth thinking about how we can make other people better. Hence my presence here today. So that's, you know, from philosophy and psychology, we can go on and on. Here it is from at least three hypotheses from biology, from an evolutionary standpoint, in terms of this conflict and what we're dealing with. And the first one, you all know, it's the parochial altruism, suggesting that humans evolved to be simultaneously cooperative in groups and aggressive towards outgroups, the us and them problem that we're all familiar with. The second one is more interesting to me. I don't know a lot about it. My daughter probably knows more than I do. The genetic conflict hypothesis. Selection pressures can operate at the gene level, creating competition between different genetic interests within a single organism for future expression. So I don't think it's the sort of thing, I've done some further reading on this and talked to some biologists. It's not the sort of thing where I wake up and I just like, I can't sleep because my genes are fighting, you know, they wouldn't let me rest. It's more from the sort of moments of conception and what happens in utero where the paternal side of things, as I understand it, looks to help fetal growth. The gene expression from the paternal side is looking to get as much fetal growth as possible, really emphasis on that particular baby. The maternal set of genes is saying, nope, let's put some in reserve for future offspring. This might happen again. And boom, and you get conflict right from the get-go, inherent, built into our genetic structure. And then there's the behavioral toolkit hypothesis. Rather than having any kind of fixed nature, some biologists argue humans possess a behavioral toolkit containing tools for both violent conflict and peaceful cooperation. Again, epigenetic expressed depending upon the environment, the kind of triggers that you come in contact with. This expresses itself, of course, in various kinds of, that conflict expresses itself in various kinds of hypocrisies as well. So next week I'm going to talk about higher education. You want to be here for that. But, you know, the right, of course, has just come down so heavily on wokeness. And if you're paying it any attention at all, right, we're at the point now in the university where I can say about three things, and that's about it. And so, you know, how you can't do that. And so here this conservative movement, which historically aligns itself with small government and non-interference in people's lives, in the lives of institutions, is deeply ingrained in our lives. You know, we want small government unless it's us, and then we want it to be all-powering and all-encompassing. And the left, you know, certainly does its fair share of this too. We're all for tolerance and understanding unless you don't agree with us. And then not only, you know, is that bad, but you really can't say it. And so the pendulum has swung, you know, in the classroom from, yeah, can't say this because it'll be canceled by the left, or can't say this because now we'll lose all our funding. on we go. Conflict at the heart of it, from the genetic level all the way through the highest metaphysical levels of religion, philosophy, etc. All right. In literature, and by the way, just one thing I really, really wish that we would spend, I don't know if any of you are teachers or influencers, or the next time you're at a school board meeting or something, we're supposed to be in one of the best school districts in Michigan, and my goodness, talking about evolution, you'd think, you know, it's like we'd shown up as the Antichrist. And one of the things I wish my students understood better coming into college, and certainly leaving college, is that natural selection is not a designer, right? Evolution has no foresight. Evolution is an efficiency model. There's no optimal endpoint. It's not teleological in the sense that it's all moving us, right? It's taking advantage of certain traits and then responding to the environment to try to survive. And I think part of what, you know, what's wrong with everybody, one, is we haven't taken the time to learn or teach one another very well about what's actually true about us. And that some of these conflicts that are at the base. I think, at least my hope is, that the more exposure people have to what science is able to tell us about how things actually work and who we actually are, there's a little bit of a calming effect to that. But you also might be sitting there thinking, well, Dwight, I'm not so sure. I've met some people who seem not conflicted at all. They seem damn sure of what they think and who they are. All right, they're either really old and they just don't care anymore. they're enlightened, and there are about four of those people on the planet, as far as I can tell. I'm going to play armchair psychologist, they probably are more in this camp, and that's either the Dunning-Kruger effect, right, which is that overinflated notion of your competencies, that no matter how awful I actually am at something, I'm fully convinced I'm the world's leading expert. There's a growing amount of that, as far as I can tell. That's become epidemic, on one hand. Or the other hand, it's pretty common stuff. And the need for anxiety, or because of anxiety, the dread, whether it's out of, you know, the impermanence of life or not feeling like, you know, the conflict. The conflict is something that's very, very hard for most of us to handle. So we've invented lots of ways to eradicate it or overcome it or paper over it, all sorts of ideologies, et cetera. And so a lot of those folks, I think, who are become absolutists in one form or another, to my mind, have not actually dealt with the conflict in an intellectually or psychologically honest way, but they have dealt with it, right? It's just up to the rest of us now to deal with that particular absolutism in our lives, all right? And a couple more things about that. So we don't want to leave out literature either. So there is Hamlet, of course. I love, one of the reasons I love, The Tempest is my favorite. Macbeth is right up there. Hamlet is worth a reread or re-seen if you haven't seen it lately. A lot of Shakespearean scholars say this is where Shakespeare really invents the human, the modern notion of the human, because Hamlet has an interior life that we don't really have access to in literature before this particular play. And you remember, of course, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you know, come in, and this whole question of how corrupt Denmark is, and they're going back and forth, and they're defending it, and Hamlet says, there's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So all through the play, Hamlet is dealing with this tremendous inner conflict. Should he avenge his father's death? Oh, I don't know. Do I really know what I think I know? And back and forth he goes, and Ophelia's like, nah, maybe a partner, maybe she isn't. I don't know what to do. Should I kill myself? No, I'm not really mad enough to do that, right? It's just this sort of wonderful exposition, obviously in Shakespearean language, for what, you know, besets an awful lot of us. And he says, maybe there's a kind of subjectivism or even relativism to this, the way that I'm thinking, that I needed to account for. And I should ask you about this, really never quite sure if that was meant in the text to be a revelation. It just came to Hamlet, in that moment, or it's something that he's reasserting. And I'm not really sure how to read it. In The Old Man and the Sea, Stoney and I were just in Key West. She was finishing some dives for her certification. She has decided that living under the sea makes more sense than living on land. I'm beginning to see the sense of that myself, actually. Anyway, we visited the Hemingway home while we're down there, as one does. And so I was thinking about that and The Old Man and the Sea, where Santiago, right, is out there and he's fighting his own aging body, his pride, right? He can't do the things that he used to be able to do. He's got this huge marlin on the line that he loves and doesn't love. All of it all comes, humanity, nature, I mean, all of it in, of course, inimitable, you know, Hemingway, quote-unquote, simple prose, where he's fighting with the fish himself, the nature of humanity, all of it. And the you did not kill the fish only to keep alive and sell for food, he thought. You killed him for pride and because you're a fisherman. You loved him when he was alive and you loved him after. If you love him, it's not a sin to kill him, or is it more? And then finally, from Dickens' Great Expectations, there's Pip, which a lot of people hold up as maybe the quintessential, along with Hamlet, conflicted. Oh, I want to be wealthy in Miss Havisham's life. You know, Estella, that's the way, that's life for me. Oh, but I've got my allegiance to my people and who I am. Am I who I was, where I come from, or am I what I aspire to? Right? And then Dickens goes on for 4,000 pages trying to resolve that. And if you haven't read that in a while, then that's your afternoon before you get to work on all the other things that we talked about earlier. The point is, let's review. What have we learned so far? We're hugely complicated. There's a lot of stuff that's going on. Much of it is in conflict, or at the very least, we seem to be paradoxical in a lot of things that we espouse, say that we want, the ideal and the real conflict on an ongoing basis. How do we defend that? How do we live with ourselves rather than just sort of, you know, eating 14,000 pizzas a day and calling it good? We've got these defense mechanisms. We've developed a whole really, you know, amazing suite of neuroses that, you know, keep people busy for long periods of time. Projection, transference, all kinds of stuff that's going on that we want to get to the bottom of. The complexities show up in everything from my point of view. And if I had one resolution, I don't want it. But it's the same one that I have probably ever since I started teaching, and that is, Dwyld, for once in your life, would you just try before you say some smart-ass thing to keep people's stories in mind? That even if they're 18 or 19 years old coming into your classroom, they may have suffered, undergone, seen things, come from a place that's hard for you to imagine. Would you not take the easy route? Would you please try to stay mindful of the very things that you keep saying other people should stay mindful of? that's one of my own internal conflicts. And confession feels really good. Thank you. I appreciate that. So I'll end with a little bit of epistemology, because I may have said this before, but I really do think, given the kinds of media we now live in and or have access to, the ways in which our tribal notions have been exacerbated and played to rather than acknowledged and tampered down. This killing of Rene Goode raises an epistemological question that some of you might not like, but I'm available for a talk back and beatings later. And that is, because of the world we live in, the kind of media that's available to us, the narrative is ahead of the facts. Very often times, right? And video makes that especially difficult, because video seems like it must be unbiased. It must be able to present to our senses a capture or give us a picture of what in fact is true. There should be no question about that. So if there is a question about it, depending on which camp you're in and which narrative you're already bought into, the other side is clearly lying. They're psychotic, they're propagandistic, they're fascist, on our side, you know, we are apologists for the worst kinds of behavior. We don't care about the lives of people trying to uphold the law, and on it goes. And it's just a nice opinion piece, just just, you know, a few hours afterwards. It said, one side saw a clear vehicular attack that justified lethal force. The other saw an unjustified killing followed by an official lie. Each accused the other of gaslighting. Each insisted the facts were obvious. Video compounds the problem because it carries the illusion of objectivity. Unlike testimony or documents that audiences recognize as interpretive, footage feels like it's unmediated reality. This is how the competing realities do and have taken hold over the last, probably since 2016. Not because the evidence is clear, but because the narrative arrives first. So, and I didn't want to go here either, but if I have one other resolution, you know, that's less lighthearted, again, than I was hoping this whole thing would be, but events occur that do need our thought and response. It's tragedy, right? No matter which narrative side you're on, this is an incredible tragedy. And as unsympathetic as you may be to this, I would argue, we'd need much more time maybe for me to tell you why, I would argue it's truly a tragedy for the guy who pulled the trigger as well. So more consequential for her, of course, but it's going to be traumatic for him also. So what do we actually know? In advance of proclaiming what we know, is it possible to have the human or humane response first? And I swear to God, of all the people in the world who I might have not expected a humane response from, it was, I can barely bring myself to say it, Tucker Carlson chastising his fellow conservatives for saying, can you guys just not go to the blame, the default, to the, you know, imputation of, you know, domestic terrorism? Can you just acknowledge this as a human tragedy and say something empathetic about that first? Whether he's doing that for propagandistic reasons or I have no idea, all right? Possible. But for this one instance, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt and say, if we're going to deal with what's so terribly wrong about all of us, not just you, me too, some moment to pause. What do I actually know? What do I feel certain about what I know? And what's the humane or human response to what is, in fact, tragic? Might not be a bad place to start 2026. Thank you.